Hello, everybody. I'm Kevin Winder, and thanks for tuning in to another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. Today's question is this. If the Song of Solomon was the only sacred text, what would religion look like? You see, love is not just a sentiment tossed around on Valentine's cards. It's not just a start of a relationship. Love is the greatest power in the universe, and its gravitational pull is always toward the unity of all things. In today's episode, I show how this amazing love poem is a microcosm, which can help us see a much bigger work in the macrocosm. Join me now as we see beyond human love and sexuality into an amazing illustration of the love of God. Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for coming back to another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. I'm so glad to have you here. Welcome to the broadcast number 160, and welcome to Sunday. You know, folks, we are in the second week of a look at the Song of Solomon. Now, like I said last week, I'm not really doing an in-depth Bible study. I'm really pulling out some of the nuances and teachings that are there from this wise person, Song of Solomon. they don't call him Song of Solomon. They just call him Solomon, conveniently. last week, we talked about the sex poet. If you didn't get a chance to listen to that, I go into pretty good detail, maybe even voyeuristically, about this sexual relationship between Solomon and his bride. And today, we're going to follow that up with the love poet. And this poetry is really important. And like I said in my in the beginning, what if the only sacred text we had was the Song of Solomon? What kind of theology would we have? What would religion look like if we did have any other teaching but what we saw? And most of you might be a little stumped by that question, and I start there because it really helps us see that the story of two lovers, the sexual interest, the passion, the drive, the desire to be together, the desire to put the other person and their needs and wishes and desires first, teaches us so much that we can learn. Love is, on the horizontal plane, something that's very powerful on the vertical plane. And so we are going to go and talk today about the love poet. That's right. It's called the love poet. And, you know, what does it really mean if this poem can expose kind of the macrocosm of love? What does that mean? What does it mean to learn how to love? What does it mean that God is love? What does it mean that humans love each other and that teaches us something about the love of God? That's what this is all about. And to kind of get at how we do that, I'm going to paraphrase what Ray Anderson says. He said, "The acts of love are the hermeneutical or interpretive horizon for the being of love. The acts of love are the hermeneutical horizon for the being of love." In other words, we know what or who love is by how love acts, right? And this is the framework that helps us kind of see something through this text. This is the framework that we're going to use to kind of pull out some of these observations. And the result is what I think is a very beautiful theology. Okay, so are you ready? I have five observations that we're going to talk about. And the first one is that love compels us. When you see this story of the Song of Solomon between Solomon and his bride, you realize very quickly that love compels us. If you've ever fallen in love, you know that love compels you to do things that you can't do under your own steam when not in love. And see, our world has some really jacked up ideas about love. And one of those jacked up ideas is that love obligates us to do the right thing, even if we don't want to do it. And I worked with a pastor who really strongly felt this way, that love obligates us. And I argued tooth and nail. We never agreed. I am absolutely convinced that if you believe that love obligates you, your life is running a malware script in the backdrop. And it's constantly being played in marriage counseling, especially in churches, right? I mean, how else do we keep marriages together when unloving people forsake love? They quit on love. They don't act at all like they did when they were falling in love. No, now they're guarded and protective and competitive and everything else. And so we're supposed to say that because we're still in a marriage that somehow we're still in love. And that is not true. You see, when you are in love and you obey love and you follow the pattern of and flow of love, then love compels you. But you see, if you need to say, well, hey, I'm in a marriage, but I'm not in love, how do you keep your marriages together? Well, this is what you do. You just tell them that, hey, love obligates you to do things. So settle for second best or third or fourth best, actually, and just do the right thing, even if you don't feel it. You see, Solomon and his bride have no sign of obligation here. They behave the way they do because love grips their heart, and it pleases them to please the other. If you're in a marriage and you're not pleased to please the other, you're not in love. Now, that doesn't mean you have to live in a loveless marriage. No, no, no. The goal is not how do I get along and not be in love. That is a failure of a marriage counselor if you're sitting in front of one. What you need to learn how to do is love again. You see, love is compulsory. It's not duty. It is a reflex. It is not a plan. It is not a strategy. It is not a four-step thing. It's not the six things you're going to do for your wife when, you know, you only do those when you decide you don't want to love. You see, and this can be seen in religious systems too. And this is the model we're using, right? We're looking at horizontal love between humanity and exploring how that really teaches us something about God. And in religion, we know that doing the right thing the wrong way is the same as doing the wrong thing. There's a story in Luke 18 of a very religious man who goes up and prays a prayer. And I mean, what could be more the right thing to do than praying a prayer? Except for the way he does it. Oh, Lord, I thank you that I'm not like this poor tax collector sitting over here, right? He's doing the right thing in the wrong way, and it's absolutely still the wrong thing. And you see, much of religion kind of falls into that category. You probably have already noticed it. And this is not me just taking digs at religion and churches and everything else. So folks, you know, enough of those kinds of things. I say this kind of stuff because you know it to be true. You just have to be honest with what you're seeing in your present reality, right? Much of religion falls into this category of doing the right thing the wrong way and convinces itself it's right, but it's actually wrong. So much of what religion does seems right on the surface, but below, you know, it's anything but love. I mean, people ascribe this malware script again to their faith that God is pleased with our duty and obligation, thinking that God is just staring down with a stink eye, just waiting to punish you if you just get out of line. You see, this poem flips the script on this, though. It illuminates a God who is passionately desiring unity with us. Passionately desiring unity. That's amazing. This kind of love really evokes reciprocation on our part. And whenever we don't reciprocate that kind of love on our part, it's because we simply do not believe that God is that loving. And you see, the couple in the story is not waiting for the other shoe to drop. There's not a sense of, you know, gosh, my king, my handsome prince is so awesome. How long is this going to last before he becomes a jerk? Or, oh man, she's so beautiful and so wonderful, and I just love her. I can't wait to be with her. How long is that going to last until she becomes a total nag? Right? You see, this is the way we approach things, and we don't love. This is not seen in the scripture, folks. we don't approach our faith that way either. We don't say, oh, God is so good, but how long until he turns on me? And no wonder, given the script that, you know, Christianity has taught everybody, oh, God loves you, Jesus loves you, unless you don't pick his team. And then he's going to be your hate and dread warrior and destroy you forever in a burning fire. Right? So it's like, no wonder people's faith is evoking this sense of, when is the other shoe going to drop? That's not found here in the Song of Solomon, and that should not be a part of our theology. The second one, the second observation I made is that love and trust go together. You know, to complete giving of oneself, right, to give oneself completely to another takes an immense amount of trust. You probably know that. And if you've been hurt in relationships, then you probably have trust issues. Now, I want you to know something, that without this self-emptying, there's a Greek word for that. It's called kenosis. Without kenosis, without self-emptying, if you're holding something back, right, love will not emerge. Right? You cannot just cautiously be optimistic in love. Sorry, folks. If you protect your heart, you will remain a spinster. Yes, you will remain a spinster. Love is not about protecting your heart. It is about giving your heart completely away. Trusting in a relationship like that, it is a big risk. But I'm sorry, it is the only way to love deeply and to love freely. You see, we confuse the order of love and trust. We're convinced that, you know, we'll love first and we'll just build on trust until that person does something that screws it up, right? Until that shoe drops, right? Remember that malware script, folks, about duty and all this? Yeah. If you get into that, you got a scorecard. You don't have love. You see, we're convinced that we'll love first and build trust later. And that order actually stifles love. It stops love's power from leaving a person. You know, and like I said, it leaves you with a scorecard instead of a loving experience. You fall completely into it. See, we trust first, and then we get all in, or else we will have no share of love. We'll have a share of skepticism. We'll have a scorecard relationship. We're keeping balance. We're checking to see. We're following up. It just makes us insecure psychotics. It's not love. Now, theologically, though, if we look at the vertical plane here, the Christ story depicts a love that is all in, 100% in, 100% trust, to the point of death. That's the kind of love that's reflected in the Song of Solomon. Think about that. Now, number three, my third observation. So we have the first observation is that love compels us. The second observation is that love and trust go together. The third observation is that lust only exists when we are not free to love. You see, you have to be in a place to love. You have to have the availability, the capability, the bandwidth to love. That's why it says, do not, you know, the little entourage of the bride's, you know, friends, she's always admonishing them, don't awaken love until it's ready. You see, lust, which a lot of people think this book is about, or they think that if you're sexually attracted to a person or physical attraction is somehow a sin or something like that, they get it all jacked up, right? But it's connected to love, right? Lust is wanting a part of a person, but not the whole person. I talked a little bit about this last week and why it's dehumanizing, because it makes an object out of a subject, right? But physical attraction is not lust. I mean, chances are very good you're going to be sexually attracted to countless people in your life. That's not the point. You see, if both parties are free and available for love, then attraction can lead to consummation. You see, the problem is satisfying the attraction when one isn't able, when one doesn't have the bandwidth, the ability, the capability to take on the whole life of the other person. That's what stifles love. So lust then is the surrogate. It's the poor trade-off that you get instead of true love. And you have to know yourself. You have to know what you're free and available to be getting into. And so those in relationships who are in loving relationships are simply not free. They're not available for another because the love that they have for the one creates a natural boundary there. Lust then is the over-desire, which is what the Greek word means, epithumia, right? Over-desire, not evil desire, as it's often translated. And it exists when love is not free to bring the consummation of attraction. And this is an important part. You know that love exists. You know that there's something more because that physical attraction leads to consummation, right? So this desire for love exists because you know that there is a consummation for this deep yearning that's within all of us. And theologically, this holds true, right? Idolatry is the forsaking of the consummation of love for something temporarily satisfying. Have you ever thought about that? Idolatry is forsaking the consummation of love for something temporarily satisfying. You see, we turn good things into God things and we objectify the subject. What our heart should be giving to the subject, we satisfy with an object. That is idolatry. See, consummation is always subject to subject, right? Sexuality is depicted so often as just face-to-face intimacy. It's body-to-body. It's oneness, right? It's deep, deep intimacy, interpersonal, deep connection. And sexuality is the physical expression of that, but we can experience this in many, many other ways, in deep, unifying connections that are not sexually related. And this is how it works theologically as well. Wow, isn't that something? Okay, number four. We're going to talk about number four is the horizontal and the vertical. And I've alluded to this already in the sense that the microcosm of a horizontal relationship really exposes us to the truth about the macrocosm of divine love in a relationship with divine love. You see, human love is the practice arena for divine love. Did you hear that? Human love is the practice arena for divine love. And so often we just want to separate these out as though they're so radically different. I'm here to tell you they're not different. You're creating a division where a division does not exist. You see, religion always messes this up. And it messes it up by elevating the love and the worship of their deity so high while they simultaneously treat those around them with contempt. Have you ever seen this happen? Of course you have. Now, Paul said that we could worship with the voice of an angel, but if we didn't have love for others, we're just noisemakers. 1 Corinthians 13. Right, they're just a big gong, sounding brass. We're just a big noise. What good is your worship of God if you do not have love for your fellow man? It is noise in God's ears. Now, this is the absolute litmus test of all real belief. And I don't care what religion you subscribe to. If you have any faith at all, and you say you believe in a deity, a God, you say you are a Christian, you're a devout Muslim who follows Allah, you're a Jew who follows Yahweh, right? You subscribe to Christianity and follow Jesus. You do not have love for your God if you treat your neighbor with contempt. You see, there are no enlightened road ragers. Sorry. If you claim to be enlightened, if you claim to have some transcendent experiences, if you claim to have some kind of love in your heart and you're a road rager, I'm sorry. You see, there's no genuine love of God if we compete with others instead of promoting others. All right, James called this dead faith, and it's really the biggest hypocrisy in the world. So many people have pulled out of religion, mainline denominations, and have given up God. They've thrown the baby out with the bathwater. Why? Because of this hypocrisy. People say they love God, but they don't love somebody else. And folks, this is a moment where you're going to have to take a sobering look at your own church or religious institution. If the place that you worship God hates certain groups of people, oh, you don't like those people because they're a different religion. If you look down on those people because of their sexual preferences, if you despise that group of people because of that behavior or that belief or whatever, and you're putting yourself as though you're better than them, that is dead faith. That is a church that has pointless worship. I'm not just being severe here. I'm actually just teaching you the Bible, right? You don't have the love of God if you despise your fellow man. Plain and simple. And what we see in Ecclesiastes is Solomon and his bride, they self-empty and they promote each other. They are compelled to do it. It's not a chore. This is how Mother Teresa and countless others like her just self-emptied for the most needy. And then they go and interview her. How can you do this work? And it's like, it's not work. It's what I love to do. It wasn't a duty for her. You see this, folks? When service replaces duty, our soul is finally meeting love. If you feel like you have an obligation to go out and talk to those darn sinners, then you are not loving. Love is not duty. Love is not obligation, right? We love God by loving others, by giving our life away for the sake of others. That is how the horizontal and the vertical connect. Okay, and lastly, the last observation I'm going to pull from the Song of Solomon is what I think is really amazing. And it may be a little confusing to you, but I'm going to do my best to kind of pull this nugget out for you. Number five is unspeakable power. You see, the last observation is the indescribable power that love produces. Physical attraction in the prime of our youth and when we're all beautiful and healthy and young and vital and all that, the physical attraction has a tremendous gravitational pull of love. And it's really depicted in this poem of Song of Solomon. This is why on youth groups, you have to take the high school girls and separate them from the high school boys at times. That gravitational pull is really strong, right? The power of love is exactly that. It is this magnetic force that overcomes any gaps in union between people. This power cannot be underestimated. I cannot underscore how powerful this magnet is. Now, you might have seen videos of these really, really strong magnets that you even get them near each other and they literally just crush anything that's in between them. That's love, okay? Love is a magnetic force that overpowers its subjects until unity is a shared experience. You see, that's the direction of love. Its power can bring anything together. Anything together. Is your marriage not going very well? Well, guess what? If you fall back in love, it's going to go great. Love will bring you back together. But of course, what's going to have to happen? You have to self-empty. You're going to have to lay down your right to need to be right. You're going to have to let go of all your objections and obligations and everything else and just be in free fall again. But can you do that? If you can, love is an opportunity for you. And to the degree that any division resides within your soul, and this could be with your wife, with your family, with your coworkers, with your neighbor, with any people group out there at all, if there's any amount of us versus them within your soul, then to that same degree, love is being resisted by you. You're the spinster who's refuses to get all in. You're the trust issue person who can't really love and then is sad that you're lonely. You see how this works, folks? Love is an unspeakable power, and it's a magnetic force that closes the gap between any disunion of people. That's what love is. That's what love does. Now, there's a passage in Deuteronomy, chapter 6, verse 4. It's called the Shema. And it says this, it says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one." Now, so often when I was growing up, boy, that was just a statement about monotheism, right? But that's not it. This is not just an argument for monotheism, folks. This is the biggest statement of complete unity ever phrased by human lips, right? What it's saying is that the love of God is unity, one. All things become one. Our differences are to be celebrated. That's what we are to celebrate, our differences, not create different denominations over our differences. They're to help grow us, expand us, make us better, right? It's to serve the purpose of expanding the love between us and expanding the love between us and the divine. This is what love is supposed to do. Our differences are not supposed to separate us. They're supposed to expand the love between us. And so, yes, the love poet can teach us something about God. Yes, a human story, a poem of sex and love can open us up into a theology that brings every tribe, every nation, every tongue, and may I say, every religion into a single frame. Yes, everybody becomes one under the banner of love. Every bit of pain that we experience, every bit of alienation, embarrassment, every kind of suffering or evil that's perpetrated on the world, every kind stems from a void where love was intended to dwell. You resist a little bit of love and you create a pocket in your life where evil and suffering will begin to fester and emerge and grow. If you backfill it with love, it is purged and cleaned once and for all. So, the longing for love that we all possess, and folks, we do all possess a deep, deep longing for love. But that longing for love that we all possess proves that there is a consummation. There is a point at which that longing can be satisfied, and that satisfaction can only be found in love.